today is number 072901, Eric Spiley against Kingston. Ms. Tripp.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Kate Lloyd Tripp, representing the respondent appellant in this matter, in which the state of Wisconsin is the real party at issue. The state asks that you reverse the decision of the district court granting Mr. Smiley habeas relief and remand the case back to the district court for a decision on Mr. Smiley's remaining claims. We do so for two reasons. The first is we believe that the Court of Appeals decision affirming the trial court's decision to admit Mr. Smiley's first statement, which denied involvement in the murder, was not a decision that was contrary to or an unreasonable application of federal law, specifically Innis or Miranda. It wasn't contrary to Supreme Court law, despite what the district court found, because the decision specifically acknowledged Miranda and applied it. Wasn't an unreasonable application because it relied on the state Supreme Court, State versus Armstrong, which relied explicitly on Innis, specifically the language in Innis that defines interrogation as words or actions on the part of police officers that they should have known were reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response. We submit that it cannot be an unreasonable application of Innis given this language. Although it was direct questioning, and there's other language in Innis that of course says that direct questioning must be preceded by Miranda, this other language about the definition of interrogation being what the police should know is likely to elicit an incriminating response has been applied in other cases as well to define interrogation. So I think that the Court of Appeals decision relying on this language and finding that the police officers, when questioning Armstrong in that case, had no reason to think that his responses would be incriminating is a reasonable application of Innis, and as such, the Court of Appeals decision in this case, applying it to a very similar circumstance to Mr. Smiley, couldn't have been, again, an unreasonable application. It could have been, we're not saying that it wasn't incorrect or that maybe if this case were on direct review again, things wouldn't be different, but under the AEDPA, we submit that it's not unreasonable. Second, the harmless error inquiry, we disagree with the assessment of the district court. Given that Brecht is the standard, Mr. Smiley needs to show a substantial and injurious effect on the verdict. So if we take out the first statement denying involvement, the evidence still shows 5 gunshot wounds on the victim, including 1 to the head, 2 of which were most certainly fatal. The guns were hidden in separate places, which one can infer that one of the guns that Mr. Smiley says was at the scene and picked up by the victim, there's really no evidence that that's true. He hid the guns in different places, so there's no fingerprint, and there's no fingerprint evidence to suggest that the victim did pick up the gun in the manner that Mr. Smiley suggests. Mr. Smiley fled the scene. He staged the scene to make it look as if a burglar had, or that the victim had interrupted a burglar. He didn't call the police immediately after the crime. He hid out at his friend's house. He has no gunshot wounds to himself. He has a bite mark on his back. That's pretty much the extent of his injuries. And
where did the police find him? When they said he was at a friend's house, what they obviously were trying to locate him, ostensibly at least, because he lived there. Where
right.
did they find him?
I believe it was at his grandmother's house.
The one who owned the house?
Right, but she lived in a different residence.
Mm-hmm. But he didn't stay there. He said he stayed at a friend's house?
Well, that's what he said.
I just wonder where they found him.
They found him at his grandmother's house.
And initiating the questioning, immediately, I guess, told him that he was not a suspect. Is that the way that
right.
worked?
Right.
Is that just a routine thing that these officers do when they bring someone in to talk about a murder?
I can't speak to what's routine or not, but I do know that in this case, the evidence shows that it looked like a burglary and that they were operating under the premise that there had been some sort of burglary or attempted burglary. And the detective's testimony is that they were focused on some sort of nearby drug house, and they asked Mr. Smiley his knowledge about the tenants of that house. The evidence, I think, does show that they did not consider him a suspect.
At what point, if this is something we can discern in the interrogation, did they conclude that maybe he was?
Well, their testimony is that...
he started crying or before that?
I think after they saw what looked like blood on his shoes and on his jacket, and in which he couldn't explain their presence.
And that wasn't initially then, when they started the interrogation?
Well, I assume it was initially there, but their testimony is that they didn't note it until later in the interview. It looked like a small amount of blood.
Same with the limb.
Correct. Okay, so again, even if you do find that there was an unreasonable application of Innis here, we do rest on our harmless error argument, which, absent his statement that he wasn't there, we don't believe that the lack of that statement, the inclusion of that statement had a substantial and injurious effect on the verdict. Okay, I'll save my remaining time then. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Tripp. We'll hear nothing from Mr. Enderick.
Good morning, judges of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals and counsel. May it please the court, my name is Rex Andrig, and I represent the petitioner appellee Eric Smiley in this case. This case revolves in large degree around the idea that the detectives denominated Mr. Smiley just a witness, not a suspect. It's sort of the cornerstone of the appellant's argument. It was the linchpin of the Court of Appeals decision, and it was also the rationale that the trial court employed in this case. Therefore, the argument goes that detectives merely conducted an interview of Mr. Smiley. They refer to it as an interview. I believe it was an interrogation, but I believe that we could all agree that it was express questioning. And as I thought about this last night, I realized the record is not particularly well developed with regard to the sequence of events in the express questioning. How did that all evolve? But a careful review of the detective's version does yield a rough chronology of events that I think shed some light on this idea that he was just a witness. According to the detectives, the questioning started at about 5 o'clock and lasted until sometime after 7. A few places in the record suggest 7:30. There's one place that suggests 8 o'clock. But the purpose for the questioning, clearly on the detectives by their version, was that it was to elicit information about who had possibly committed this homicide. And the detectives did tell Mr. Smiley at the beginning of the interview that he was not a suspect. And by the way, Mr. Smiley confirmed that when he testified briefly at the post-conviction motion hearing. So there's no question about that. But it's also true that immediately at the beginning of the questioning, they noticed that he had, quote, a very noticeable limp. And they also noted at the beginning that he had abrasions on his forehead and on his fingers. And Mr. Smiley was expressly questioned at the beginning of the interview how he got those injuries, and thus began his series of false statements, which would ultimately become the first statement in question.
Is this absolutely essential to the analysis that you're asking us to adopt today?
Is what essential, Your Honor?
The facts that you're giving us here.
I think they do inform. I don't know that they're essential, but I think it's
important. The essential point was your guy was in custody, and they questioned him. Isn't that your basic point today?
It is my basic point today, is that he was in custody and that he was questioned. So I'll turn at this point to...
By giving us these other facts, it sounds like you're almost adopting the state's view.
Well, I'm not adopting the state's view. I just want the court to understand how this took place.
Thanks.
But you're
Thanks.
Correct, because if I do adopt the position that it was important what Mr. Smiley perceived, then I would be adopting the state's view. But I would agree with the court, or at least what's implied, is that that is not essential to the issue here, that what Mr. Smiley perceived objectively is not relevant, because there is no dispute here other than that he was expressly questioned. And while what he might have perceived may have been important under some analyses to the question of whether or not he was in custody, it's not relevant to the question of whether or not he was interrogated, because there was expressed questioning. I think then I would turn at this point to the state's position regarding the harmless error and the fact, and it's in the briefs as well, that they still could have attacked Mr. Smiley's credibility even if they did not have this first statement. And there's no question that absent the error, in this case, there was other evidence the state still could have introduced to show consciousness of guilt. But I think there's a significant difference between credibility and consciousness of guilt. And I think the difference is important enough that if this court doesn't take a close look at it, there's a real danger that it won't be looking at the correct harmless error analysis. The real issue here, in terms of the harmless error issue, was the credibility of Mr. Smiley's self-defense statement, the second statement. What did Mr. Smiley tell the police about what had happened when they sat him down and asked him what had happened? And it's true that even without the error in this case, the jury still would have heard that Mr. Smiley, after shooting Mr. Garrett, made the scene look like a burglary gone bad, and that he left the scene and that he hid the guns. But it is also true, and I think more important to the harmless error analysis, is that absent the error in this case, the jury would have also heard that when the police sat Mr. Smiley down and asked him what had happened, he said, after shooting Garrett, I made the scene look like a burglary gone bad, and then I left the scene, and then I hid the guns. And by the way, let me take you and show you where the guns are, and let me tell you how all of this transpired. And so his self-defense statement would therefore have come in a context where right out of the gate he's freely admitting that he panicked and told the police officers what had happened. And this would have greatly diffused the impact of this other evidence. And in fact, rather than hurting him, I think Smiley's admission to those acts would have imbued his self-defense statement with even greater credibility. Returning to the issue about Mr. Smiley being told that he was not a suspect, it's not really relevant, as I stated earlier, because the detectives expressly questioned him. And there's no question he was in custody, and the Supreme Court precedent doesn't allow express questioning to be turned into something else. Simply by uttering the magic words, you're not in custody, before asking a custodial suspect what he might know about a particular homicide.
Well, he was clearly in custody, they say, for a different reason.
They say,
or at least ostensibly for a different reason.
They say that he was in custody, yes, for a different reason.
Because there was a warrant out for his arrest for something else.
Right. But I think we do have clear Supreme Court precedent that indicates, and that would be the Mathis case, that the reason a person is in custody is irrelevant to the analysis. Once the person is in custody, if there's going to be express questioning, then there's a rule here that says that the Miranda warnings must be read. And I think it's also important to recall that this is a rule of law, as opposed to some legal standard like probable cause might be, where there's some wiggle room for a court. Here, it's basically if you've got A plus B, which is a person in custody and express questioning, then there's a rule that says that the person must be read the Miranda warnings before you go ahead and start questioning him. The government's view here is essentially that the decision by the State Court of Appeals, which, by the way, never incorporated it into its analysis, any examination of the fact that Mr. Smiley was told that he was not a suspect. They sort of relied on that idea, that was mentioned in the factual portion of the decision, but the actual analysis doesn't even go down that road in terms of what Mr. Smiley would have perceived. But the government's view is that the state court appellate decision is reasonably erroneous, and I don't see anything reasonable about it, but I would note before addressing that that the other independent prong of the habeas corpus statute is even more compelling here, because the decision is clearly contrary to United States Supreme Court precedent. And as I indicated, Mathis instructs us that it doesn't matter why a person is in custody. So here we have a state court applying a rule that contradicts United States Supreme Court law, because it's saying that a person can be in custody and can be expressly questioned about a homicide without the Miranda warning. And it also reaches, I think, that what I would call a contradictory rule by using a wrong legal framework. It took the Armstrong case, which was a Wisconsin Supreme Court case. This Court of Appeals in this case relied on that Armstrong case, and as counsel has indicated, that in turn had relied on Innis. The Supreme Court case, or the Court of Appeals case here did not cite Innis, but it cited Armstrong, which had relied on Innis. And it came up with sort of a new but faulty legal framework, and under which express questioning no longer equals interrogation unless the interrogators also believe the questions are reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response. That's an amalgam of two different alternatives that Innis looked at, but Innis did not create that new legal framework which was created in this particular case. It sort of engrafted the functional equivalent of questioning, which was a separate inquiry, onto the express questioning prong. I also wanted to speak briefly about the burden of proof here, because the state has indicated that the burden is on Mr. Smiley. And while I do think that's a bit of a red herring, and what's most important is the standard here, which is whether constitutional error had a substantial and injurious effect on the jury verdict. To the extent it matters who bears this burden, I think the United States Supreme Court has made clear in O'Neill versus McKenich that it is the government which bears the burden at this stage. O'Neill was a habeas case like this one. It addressed the language that I'm sure the court is familiar with from Kodiakus, not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but that standard that if there's grave doubt about whether an error is harmless, the court must resolve that in favor of the petitioner. But the reason that O'Neill, I think, is instructive on this issue is because in that particular case, the district court said it had grave doubt, but it had grave doubt as to whether the error was harmless or as to whether the error was not harmless, and it was what they said they were in. It was an equipoise and that particular issue. And so O'Neill sort of addressed the issue of who wins when there is a tie, and that ultimately, I think, is what establishes a burden of proof. And O'Neill stated that the petitioner wins in that case because liberty interests are at stake and because traditionally the burden on a harmless error issue is traditionally on the beneficiary of the application of that rule. And in this particular case, that would be the government.
If this case is retried, is there any way your client could testify?
He could testify.
Would he be impeached?
He testified. If he chose to testify, he could be impeached with the statement that we are saying should have been suppressed.
So that wouldn't...
I don't believe he would testify.
Yeah.
I'm speculating.
I'm just curious. As far as prejudice and inevitability and things like that, it goes back in a changed complexion under any event.
It does change the complexion of the case. But certainly, the way this first statement was used against him, I think it changes the complexion of the case in a way that's much more favorable to him in terms of presenting his story, because it will his story, his self-defense statement is all that will be put in front of the jury. And, of course, then the state won't be able to undermine that as effectively as it did by using his first statement against him. And I know that's in the brief, so I won't spend a lot of time on that, but it was used repeatedly throughout the trial to great effect and very powerfully on multiple occasions during the closing argument. I will say also in terms of the burden of proof issue, or at least in terms of clarifying the district court's decision here, is that it did say that it had grave doubt about the correctness of this decision, or rather the harmlessness of the error. But in this particular case, it was not saying that it was sort of in equipoise, as I stated the O'Neill case indicated, but rather that it had grave doubt that you could say that this error was harmless because of the way that it was used. And I guess in closing, I'll just touch on one thing that you asked, Judge, and that was how it was that Mr. Smiley was picked up. And I think it is important to note that although they told him he wasn't a suspect, when he called in, it was the homicide inquiry that provoked his arrest. And ostensibly, he was under arrest for a municipal warrant. But it was the homicide call when he called in to ask them, you want to talk to me, that provoked their response. And they didn't say, come on down. They sent multiple squad cars out there. And when they got there, they didn't say, can you tell us about this? And at the end, by the way, we'd like to clear up this municipal warrant. They just took him into arrest. And it was the arrest that provoked and later prolonged. And rather, it was the homicide investigation that provoked and later prolonged his arrest. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Enderich. How much time does Ms. Tripp have? Thank you.
Okay, just a couple of things. Just to be clear, the state doesn't dispute that there was custody and that there was questioning. The state's position is that the Court of Appeals decision finding that the first statement was admissible was not an unreasonable application of Innis, given the language in Innis that says that the interrogation can extend only to words and actions on the part of police officers that they should have known were reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response. Given that language, our position is that the Court of Appeals' reliance on that language, implicit reliance on that language, is not unreasonable. The second point I'd like to make is that Mr. Smiley's story was presented to the jury, and that was before the jury, and they heard the entire second statement. Now, if we were to go back and retry it without that statement, the jury would have before it his second statement, his story, his version of events. Additionally, they would have the 5 gunshot wounds to the victim, including 1 in the head, the minimal injuries to Mr. Smiley, the fact that the scene had been staged, the guns had been hidden. There are no fingerprint evidence supporting Mr. Smiley's position that Mr. Garrett's grabbed the .22, him fleeing the scene, him hiding at his friend's house. All of this would have still been there to undermine his credibility in his story. So I submit again that the error here was harmless. And I guess just a short word about the O'Neill standard, which the grave doubt, I think that you don't get to the equipoise until you have this grave doubt in the verdict. And I think that under Brecht, the language still says that the petitioner must show that there was a substantial and injurious effect on the verdict. So I'm not sure that it matters in this case who holds the burden, but the state's position is still that the burden is on the petitioner to show prejudice. And, of course, it's true that generally in harmless error on direct review, the state, or the beneficiary of the error, bears the burden, but things are normally flipped in habeas, and we submit that this is one more example of that. So, unless there are any questions, we ask that you reverse the decision of the district court and remand for further proceedings.
Thank you, Ms. Tripp.
Thank you.
Well, the court thanks Ms. Tripp and Mr. Anderig for their presentations. The case will be taken under advisement.